And tonight on Coast to Coast, we shall talk about the universe solved. And are we living in a simulation? Jim Elvidge joins us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Jim Elvidge was with us a couple of years ago. He holds a master's degree in electrical engineering from Cornell University. His applied in training and high tech has taught him to be a leader in technology and enterprisal management. For many years, he's kept pace with the latest research, theories, discoveries in the varied fields of subatomic physics, cosmology, artificial intelligence, nanotechnology, and of course, the paranormal. Jim, welcome back. How are you?
Great. How you doing, George?
It's 2 years. Back. 2 years zoom by, don't they?
Oh, they sure do. Right. And it gets faster every year.
Strangely so. What's new with you?
Well, I've been keeping very busy with the day job, of course, in the software field, but also doing a lot on The Universe Solved in my spare time. I've got the book now finally getting into an e-book form.
Super.
That should be available in about a month or so. Doing a lot of, still collecting evidence for digital reality and programmed reality. There's always things out there, keeping up with cosmology and nanotech and so forth, and actually doing some deep dives recently into the nature of matter and consciousness, which I'm sure we'll have plenty of time to talk about tonight.
Absolutely. How'd you get interested in universal things?
I guess it was a slow progression. For some reason, George, I've always been fascinated with things that are a little outside of the mainstream, alternative theories for things. I remember years ago reading a book by Paul Davies called Other Worlds. Mm-hmm. Was my first introduction to the many worlds theory of quantum mechanics, and that just kind of blew my mind at the time. And after that, I was just an enthusiast for any new ideas, any new theories, things that were different and kind of pushing the bleeding edge of science, and just love that stuff. So over the years, I've kind of branched out, I guess, a little bit into some areas that people would call metaphysics, into nature of consciousness and paranormal and things like that. And it all kind of ties together in a big way.
In your work, The Universe Solved, you hit on what is called life of a simulation. Explain what that is.
Yeah, that's sort of the central idea. Now, I do have to say ahead of time that I'm not necessarily a believer in this.
Okay.
But I'm the kind of person that likes to collect evidence, and I think in terms of, well, this is more likely than that, or the evidence points to this, or whatever, those kind of things, as opposed to like a hardcore 100% belief. That said, all of the evidence seems to point to the idea that our world is made of bits, it's made of data, and it's, in some ways, seems to follow some patterns that are very similar to the patterns that you would see in a computational system. Maybe not necessarily the PC or laptop sitting on your desk, but something that is a little more organized and a little more programmatic, if you will, than total randomness.
Well, and when I hear the word simulation, to me it sounds like we're living in a virtual world, a dream state. Is that possible?
Yes, definitely possible, and I'm sure you've heard of the simulation argument that Oxford philosopher Nick Bostrom put forth back in the late 90s, I think. Ironically, it came out at the same time that the movie The Matrix did, and 13th Floor and some of those other films. So it was almost like there was this confluence of thought there, in philosophical circles and Hollywood. But, his paper is about the idea that at some point, we're going to get to the point where we can create simulations of reality, a different reality, a fantasy reality, perhaps. Computationally, we'll be able to do that. And that point might be, given Moore's law and where things stand today, it might be 20 or 30 years away. He calls that a post-human stage. So at that point, we'll create millions of these things, probably, millions of virtual realities. So his argument goes like this. There's three possibilities. We're either living where we think we are 20 or 30 years before this post-human stage, and we never get to it because we blow ourselves up as a civilization.
Mm-hmm.
Or two, we never get to it because we make a conscious decision not to pursue that kind of technology. And I don't know about you, but I think that that one's probably not very likely. I mean, when have we ever not pursued something that was sitting right in front of us? We do it all the time with nuclear energy and nanotech and cloning and all kinds of things that potentially have some dangers. And then the third possibility is that we do reach that post-human phase. When we do, we create millions and millions of these reality simulations. So the odds in that case that we're in the one prior to that is very, very small compared to the odds that we're in one of those millions. So the way it kind of nets out is that, you know, this logical argument says that if you're a pessimist, you believe we're going to destroy ourselves in the next 20 or 30 years. If you're an optimist, you have to believe that we're probably living in a simulation.
You know, could we possibly be living on someone's dream, basically?
I don't know about that, because that kind of feels like we wouldn't have free will,
right?
In a sense, you know, it. You know, I tend to believe in the idea of free will. I think there's some good evidence for it, actually. And behind a lot of the things that I wrote about, there is scientific evidence. This isn't all just stuff that inspired me by a movie or by, you know, just kind of thinking out of the box. There's actually some good data behind this. And, you know, the idea that we might be in somebody's dream, to me, feels a little bit like we would have no control. And, you know, where would our seats of consciousness be then if we were in somebody else's dream, right?
That could be. NASA scientists are beginning to think this. There was an article in New Science magazine about this. So mainstream's beginning to think about this.
It really is. And that's, to me, that's actually encouraging, because 4 years ago, it's almost 5 years ago now since I wrote the book, there weren't that many people talking about this kind of thing. Tom Campbell wrote his book, My Big Toe, around the same time, which is an excellent book. I'd recommend that to anybody who likes this kind of topic. Nick Bostrom was talking about it, Ed Fredkin, digital physics pioneer, and a few others. Seth Lloyd had written something in 2006 called Programming the Universe. He's an engineering professor at MIT. So some, you know, heavyweight scientists and deep thinkers and futurists and so forth were talking about this back then, but they were really in the minority. And interestingly, I wrote an article and submitted it to New Scientist magazine in 2008, right after the book was published, and they were very professional and respectful and everything, but the editor said, sorry, you know, it's just too fringe right now for us to publish. And wouldn't you know it, 2 weeks ago, they have an article written by that same editor, by the way, called Is the Universe Made of Numbers?
Huh.
So, yeah, it definitely has hit mainstream. It seems like every week one of the people on our forum, on our website, or some friend or colleague sends me another link to other research or other postulates that people are coming up with at various universities around the world. And it's, you know, there's definitely some momentum building, I think, behind this idea. It's very interesting.
Jim, sometimes it's difficult to tell really the differences between reality and what an illusion might be. Does that have much to play with this?
Yeah, absolutely, George. It's virtually impossible to tell. If you really kind of think through the way our reality works, you know, when we see things, we are really experiencing what? We're experiencing electromagnetic waves or photons, if you will, from light bouncing off of something and then striking the retina in our eyes, which causes some electrochemical reaction in the retina of our eye and sends a digital signal to the cerebral cortex in our brain, or the visual cortex in the brain, and then it gets processed by the brain. And it's not, you know, so there's all of this stuff going on that, you know, we have a subjective view of reality. You could theoretically intercept that signal and reproduce it with an artificial signal and generate the same kind of stimulus, and for all intents and purposes, you would have no idea that you weren't experiencing a real reality. So technically, it's impossible to tell the difference between what is real and what isn't real. And it, you know, when you kind of get down to it, what is real is actually a very good question.
Sometimes in a dream, it seems so real, you can't tell the difference between reality and the illusion. And sometimes when you wake up, you have to think for just a few moments to go, did that really happen to me? And then you realize it was just a dream. Why are dreams so powerful that they seem so real?
Yeah, a good question. I mean, it was something that psychologists have been dealing with for years. Some people think that the dream state is just as real as our reality state. And that idea even goes back to some ancient Chinese philosophers. They can be real because it's those processes in your brain that are creating imagery. The same kind of electrochemical processes that are creating the imagery that you're perceiving when you're dreaming that you would perceive in real life. So there's no way, you know, the only reason a dream might seem a little funnier is because you don't have sort of an ego kind of controlling the dream, making sure that it all makes sense and that it all fits the physics of the dream state, for example. You know, that's why in that movie Inception, he had a little token that he used to tell whether he was in a dream state or not.
Right. Just, good point.
You know, kind of an idea. I forget what they called that, but it was just a way to determine which was real. Without something like that, pretty much impossible to tell at some point until you actually wake up, and it makes you wonder. You know, what if we wake up from this? And some people even say that our death is waking up from an experience. You might not call it a dream, but the experience of living in this physical matter reality, if you will, is just as unreal as a dream is in this reality. So we go to a more real place after we die, perhaps.
That's possible. That's possible. Your theory, too, is that matter's nothing but data. What does that mean?
Oh, now this is a good one. This is where I've been recently. You're familiar with the idea of kind of extrapolating trends, right?
Or projecting into the future, right?
Exactly, yes. So, for example, if somebody were to say the population of some city is a million people and it's growing at a rate of 1%, say 10%, per year, then you could fairly safely say 2 years from now, it's going to be 1.21 million people, something like that. And that's sort of a linear extrapolation. There are exponential extrapolations like Moore's law, which says that we double the density of transistors on a chip every couple of years. And so with that projection, which has been going on for the last 40 years, it's pretty safe to say that 3 years from now, we'll have 8 times the density on a chip. But I don't know that anybody's really kind of extrapolated the trend of data. And I've done a lot of thinking about this, and it's really very interesting. If you go back to kind of the earliest point where people thought about something that was reasonable in terms of what's the ultimate constituent of matter, you got to go back to the ancient Greeks. Democritus, the guy whose name generated democracy, actually, was the philosopher who came up with the idea of the atom. And if you had, say, a gold bar, and you keep on breaking it into smaller and smaller bits, at some point he would say, you can't break it up any further, and that's the point when you have an atom. And his view was atoms are like little billiard balls, little round balls, and they're all jammed together in something solid. So if you think about it, let's call that aspect of matter stuff, because matter is a very confusing word, and I like to use the word stuff. It's the physical thing.
That might be easier to understand.
I think it is. I think people know what you mean when you say stuff. But if you have these atoms jammed together in his model, then, of course, there's space between little billiard balls, between spheres. Theoretically, you could have a gold bar that was 74% stuff and 26% empty space. And that view of matter was resurrected by John Dalton in the early 1800s. So at that point, early 1800s, we're still where we were in terms of the view of matter that we were back in Greek times. Now, in the early 1900s, Ernest Rutherford discovered that these atoms are mostly empty space. There's a nucleus in there that is, the size of the nucleus is one part in 10 to the 15th. It's a quadrillion. That's the ratio of stuff to empty space in an atom. So now our gold bar has gone from being 74% stuff to one part in one followed by 15 zeros. There's almost no stuff in it at all. But it didn't end there, George. In the 60s, Murray Gell-Mann and George Zweig discovered quarks, and they've done some estimates of the sizes of quarks and determined that these protons and these other particles that quarks make up are mostly empty space. And quarks are, again, a much, much tinier component of stuff. So in reality now, as of the 1960s, the view of the ratio of stuff to empty space was one part in 10 to the 30th. Now, that ratio is roughly like a grain of sand is to the size of the Earth. That's one in one to the 10 to the 32nd. So that's what we're talking about, how tenuous matter is as of the 60s. Then along come the string theorists in the 80s and 90s.
The Michio Kaku's, right?
Yep, absolutely, and Brian Greene and others. And they say that these quarks are actually mostly something else. They're strings that vibrate at certain frequencies. And these frequencies, depending on the particle, you have a different frequency for each particle, but it's all the same stuff. It's just this string, and the width of this string is like the Planck length, which is 10 to the minus 35th meters. It's unimaginably small, 20 orders of magnitude below the size of an atom. So now if you believe this, then we have one part in 10 to the 52, one part of stuff in 10 to the 52 of empty space. So you can see what the trend is here. Every 50 years, matter becomes another quadrillion times more tenuous. So where are we going with this? I can actually, this is an exponential trend that if you follow it out, you can kind of predict that in 20 or 30 years, they're going to validate string theory, perhaps isolate strings, maybe, if string theory really is the right thing, which I have some doubts. But at some point, somebody's going to say, you know what, there's two different kinds of strings. So therefore, we need a fundamental particle that makes up all those strings, and let's call those bits or something. I don't know. But eventually, we're going to get to such a ridiculous amount of, empty space to stuff ratio that people are just going to say, you know what, there is no stuff. It's just data.
What would you call dark matter? Stuff also?
Dark matter is probably just data with a different set of rules on how it behaves. So, for example, how does this, we touch something hard and we think, we're feeling something. We're feeling stuff, right?
Yeah.
But what we're really feeling, we're not feeling anything. The atoms in our fingertips don't touch the atoms in the wall or the desk that we're touching. What happens is there's the force from the electron shell and the atoms on the tips of your fingertips repel against the force in the electron shell of the atoms on the desk. So that repulsion is over a very short distance. It doesn't happen until you actually get really, really close, and then suddenly you feel it.
Hold on, Jim. More to come on Coast to Coast AM as we talk about the universe solved. Hey, are you passionate about something? You can sound off every Wednesday. A Coast to Coast listener gets to sound off. Simply send us your sound off at editorial@coasttocoastam.com. editorial@coasttocoastam.com. Include your phone number, and Tom may call you and get you to record your sound off just like this.
Hello, my name is Lewis. I'm from Spokane, Washington, and this is my sound off. My question and passion is, why is it that we have 23 million people that are unemployed, And why haven't we used it to build more oil refineries, hospitals, schools, prisons, infrastructure, first responders, roads, and everything else? If it's a question of money and who will pay for it, who cares? Let's just do it because it has to be done. Such projects will bring back much-needed hope and joy to be called an American again. Instead of instilling hope in everyone, government has now taken the course of instilling fear to control the masses. This is Lewis from Spokane, Washington, and this has been my Sound Off.
Jim Elvidge with us, his book, The Universe Solved. Jim, we were talking about dark matter and what that is and how that may be different from some of this. So I'll let you pick up from there.
Sure. What's interesting, George, is recently they've shown some imagery of where the dark matter is in the universe. And one of the thoughts about dark matter used to be that, well, we just got the equations of gravity wrong, or, you know, it could be explained by, you know, tweaking some equations of physics. But these pictures, to me, prove that that's not the case, that the equations aren't wrong. There really is something out there, because it isn't in a kind of symmetrical, position. It's loose filaments throughout the galaxy, and it's really very interesting the way it's shown there. It almost looks like, you know, what you might see in an astrophotograph of some filament of dust or something like that. So it really does seem like there is something out there called dark matter. What is it? When we were talking just before the break about the fact that you don't really need stuff to feel things, there can be things out there that we don't feel at all. For example, neutrinos are a particle that were predicted a long time ago. They were finally found many years after they were predicted, and they can just pass through all the way through the Earth. They can just go. You know, there's supposedly, you know, billions of them flying through your every square inch of your body every second from the sun, but you don't even know it. They don't do anything. They don't interact with you, but they're there.
Right.
And dark matter is the same way. It doesn't interact, but it actually interacts enough to influence gravity just a little bit. So it seems to be the kind of thing that, if matter really is ultimately just data, dark matter is probably also just data, but it's following a different set of rules than the data that we see in our normal world.
How did this, if this is all just data, how did it all get here?
That's a good question. I don't think I have that answer. I don't have any answer, really. You know, a lot of this is, I'm kind of a synthesizer, if you will. You know, I take a step back and I look at the research in all kinds of different areas, cosmology and quantum physics and, biochemistry and things like that, and try to put together, you have to put together a picture that explains everything, right? So where did it all come from? You know, one of the ideas that I kind of like the best is one from Tom Campbell. And you know, his view is that there was something originally that he calls AUM, and that it slowly evolved into something that had a difference here and there, and that difference, through sort of a process of evolution of reality, created the digital fabric of reality. It's kind of a wild idea, but it actually hangs together pretty well.
And now, is he the one that came up with the theory of everything?
Yes.
That's him. Okay.
And his book is called My Big Toe.
That's right.
The Theory of Everything. A lot of people
have
those.
Same one you were talking about. Yeah.
Sure, yeah. Physicists have used their standard model. It used to be called a theory of everything. So it's sort of a generic term that explains everything. But this whole digital reality idea really does explain everything. And it explains all kinds of anomalies that no other explanation can cover.
Well, he was huge, still is. He's still alive, I think.
Yes.
Into metaphysics and the nature of consciousness and all that, wasn't he?
He was. He was. He worked with.
And he's a physicist.
He's a physicist, and he worked with the Monroe Institute. Was it Robert Monroe?
The late Robert Monroe.
Late,
yeah.
Robert Monroe, and did some really amazing research there. I think it was just fantastic stuff that is kind of probing the edge of reality. You know, we all live in a comfort zone. We have our car we get into and we go to work and we look out in the sky and this is our world. Our world does keep on getting bigger as scientists find out more and more about it.
He was with us about 5 years ago, I think.
Yes, he was. Yeah. I looked it up. He did an interview in 2007, I think.
Yeah.
It was right around the time when his book came out.
You mentioned the Monroe Institute, then I remember talking to him about it.
You got a good memory.
I better have something. There's a bridge then, because with consciousness, with metaphysics, and with this hard data of science, there's a bridge here. You're walking down this bridge, Jim. Which side are you on? Are you, or do you go right down the middle?
What do you mean by
the side of science or the side of metaphysics?
Actually, both. So yeah, I guess you could call it the middle. I think that there is tremendous scientific research that supports some of these ideas we're talking about, and even scientific research that supports ideas like that consciousness isn't really an artifact of the complexity of your brain, that the seat of consciousness isn't all in your brain. There's actually more evidence, more scientific evidence done with kind of rigorous studies that supports that idea than evidence that supports that consciousness does come from the complexity of your brain.
Hmm.
So, for example, they've developed a computer system. It's IBM's. I forget what it's called at the moment, but it runs in 16 petaflops. It's called the Sequoia. 16 petaflops, and it's considered to have more capacity than human beings' brains do. But that's not, there's no evidence that there's consciousness there. That's right. That's still a deterministic system. And then, you could look at the internet. The internet has more interconnections than our brains do. So if it's complexity that we're talking about, the internet's just as complex as our brain, but it doesn't seem to really be developing consciousness on its own.
Why not?
I think because it's not meant to be. I think it's still a deterministic system. I think our consciousness is somewhere else. I think we have free will. That free will is driven by intent from another place, and it uses our brain to experience this physical matter reality that we experience day to day.
Well, that could be, but that tells you that there's something strange going on here, because most researchers working in the computer industry, don't they think that computers eventually will have the ability to be just like the human brain?
A lot of them do. Yeah, a lot of the artificial intelligence researchers think that consciousness will eventually emerge. I think of it a little differently. I think that we could talk a lot about the, kind of the evidence, the scientific evidence that consciousness is external to the brain. But before doing that, if we assume that, then consciousness is making a decision to occupy a brain, if you will. If it's external, or if any component of it is external, then it is, it is deciding something about where it's going to reside. So a computer that's complex enough to experience reality in some way, I don't see any reason why consciousness outside of that computer couldn't say, hey, I want to occupy that machine. But I don't think it necessarily emerges from the machine. Does that make sense?
Let me think. It is complex.
It is complex.
What is your definition of consciousness?
I guess awareness, perhaps. Thinking about being able to reflect on yourself and your existence. And, some of the interesting data on that comes from things like near-death experiences. I don't know if you're familiar with, I think Pim von Lommel's been on your show as well. And he's a cardiologist who wrote a book that is just full of 20 years of research into near-death experiences, done with what appears to be some pretty good scientific rigor. And in one case, there was a woman who, she was actually a singer from Georgia, if I remember, and she had an embolism in her brain, and the only way that they were able to operate on her was to completely drain the blood out of her brain. Effectively, I think they had to turn her upside down, put her in a chilled state, and perform the operation, and then bring the blood supply back into the brain. So during that time that the blood was out of her brain, there was absolutely no way she could be conscious according to traditional science, right? You know, she had no electrical signal, there was no sugar flowing through her brain, there was nothing that would have allowed, certainly not a lucid consciousness in her brain at all. And yet she had an experience. She recalled the conversations that the doctors and the nurses were having while this was going on, to the point where when she recounted those conversations afterwards, they were stunned. And she had a lucid near-death experience during that time. And they can track the time when she had this experience, and it was during the time when she had no blood in her brain.
How about the neuroscientist who came out and has now said that he's convinced the afterlife exists?
That's great. Yeah. There are quite a few that once you let go of the preconceived notions that we have that kind of bind our thinking, and you just say, okay, I'm going to look at the data, and I'm going to forget what I was taught, and I'm going to, what was it that Yoda said in Star Wars, you must unlearn what you have learned. Unlearn some things and start with a clean slate and look at the data, you come to a different conclusion than what mainstream science comes to. Out-of-body experiences is another example. How can people have out-of-body experiences if the seat of their consciousness is in the brain?
Well, and then what happens when the brain dies physically? All this is supposed to still continue.
Yeah, exactly. And that's another thing that I've never really understood. I've done some research on the cells of the brain, and when do they actually become dead in the sense of unable to reanimate? You know, it's actually much longer than the minutes that people typically say. I mean, there's some evidence that brain cells can be regenerated hours after death. So, but we can't reliably reanimate a dead person. You can't take somebody who's been dead for 5 minutes or so, start pumping blood through them, and have them reanimate, despite the fact that their cells really haven't died, or enough of their cells haven't died that should make it impossible to reanimate.
Well, you know, I've always wondered, Jim, when they say, you know, a lack of oxygen, the brain dies. Why does the brain appear to die so quickly? 3 minutes, 5 minutes, no oxygen.
Yeah, I think the official story is that the cells start disintegrating without the oxygen. But again, there's some conflicting evidence about that. There's some data that shows that cells last a lot longer than previously thought. And so, you know, they can, and it has a little bit to do probably with the you know, where those cells are and with the temperature of the brain. That's why they had to chill that one woman who had the operation. So I'm sure it depends on a lot of things, but if those cells really don't become completely useless, doesn't it make sense that you could reanimate somebody through forcibly pumping blood through them again? But it's impossible. It doesn't happen.
Well, some people who are at the bottom of an icy pool, they somehow can stay down there a half hour and they're okay.
Sometimes, yeah, absolutely. The other thing they would have to explain is the following. There are something like 100 trillion synapses in your brain. If you allow that maybe each synapse is the equivalent of a bit of data in terms of storage, memory storage, your brain would have the capacity of about 12 terabytes. Some researchers have done some estimates that the brain actually processes about 3 million times that much data in a human's lifetime. So Simon Berkovich is one who's done this calculation. It's something I've always wondered, you know, how much data flows through our brain and how much can we actually store? Because you always hear that under hypnosis you can recall anything. So I wondered about this and did a little research and found that, indeed, there's a factor of 3 million of compared to how much data you process throughout your lifetime versus how much data your brain can hold. So that would imply that you're losing about one out of every, you know, 3 million bits of data that comes through your brain. So if that's true, how do you explain autistic savants, hyperthymesia, eidetic memory, total recall, those kinds of things, where people can actually recall, they can be asked, you know, what happened on this particular morning of your life.
And they're brilliant. They're brilliant with that.
Yeah, exactly. So how can they recall those kind of things if the brain capacity isn't enough to hold all the data needed to recall those things?
What if it's possible that memory and knowledge may not just be stored in the brain, but in other parts of the body?
Well, I think there's a little bit of evidence for that. There does seem to be some, and I don't know too much about this, but I've read some things about how when people have heart transplants or different kinds of organ transplants, that they tend to adopt some personality traits of the person.
Of the donor.
The donor, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, so that kind of reflects the idea that maybe there is some memory there in DNA or in other parts of the body. But
I know my daughter years ago had to have a cadaver's disc put in her neck. Scared the heck out of us when she had that operation, Jim. But
wow.
She had that done. She's doing very well.
Good.
But she started having these weird, weird dreams. Extremely strange. And it was truly amazing. I think she was picking up whoever was that donor. She was picking something up.
Very, very well may have. That's really interesting. And, you know, yet one more data point that kind of corroborates a lot of the other research that's gone on around this.
It's amazing stuff.
It is. And so, you know, I think sometimes in terms of, and it's probably not good to think this way because, you know, if our reality is really as complex as I think it probably is, the idea of some external storage mechanism or some computational device behind it is just beyond my comprehension. But I still use the, you know, some knowledge about how computer systems work today, and I think in terms of, you know, how might you, you know, construct a robot, for example, to appear to be as human as possible and to appear to have access to all of its memories. It's pretty simple. The brain of that robot could be like a cache that stores all of the data that it needs to go about its normal day-to-day operation. The names of the people that the robot communicates with every day and the skills that it needs to perform its job function or whatever. But all the rest of the stuff could be stored out on the network somewhere, in the cloud, if you will. And if you put the robot under hypnosis and ask them, you know, what happened on this particular day, they could always reach out to the network and pull that data in.
Jim, when we come back, I want to talk about parallel realities with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.